an ancient city, an enigmatic religious sect, corruption, murders, and a school teacher turned detective determined to solve a mystery. Today, our Crime in the City mystery novel series takes us to the 2,000-year-old city the Romans called Neapolis, or Newtown. Today, it's called Nablus, the Palestinian city in the occupied West Bank. The layers of history and bustling old Kasbah in Nablus are inspiration and setting for Matt Bynan Reese's forthcoming novel, The Samaritan's Secret. It's the latest in his Omar Youssef mystery series. NPR's Eric Westervelt takes us there with the author.
It's peak long past. Nablus's old Kasbah still bustles. Local vendors ply their wares along the narrow stone streets. There's a decaying yet still vibrant feel to the market. Boys hawk pirated DVDs and cheap Chinese plasticware beneath Ottoman-era architecture, where at times the smell of fresh-baked pita bread blends distastefully with Nablus's still underdeveloped sewage system.
All these alleys that we're going to be walking down are covered, vaulted. There's the smell of damp because the sun never gets to them. To me, the Kasbah is the perfect setting for a mystery novel, because it is a mysterious place.
For years, Matt Reese covered news in Nablus as the Jerusalem bureau chief for Time magazine. Now a mystery writer, Reese has returned to Nablus to set the third installment of his Omar Youssef mystery series. Underfoot, there are remains of empires. Above, posters of dead young Palestinian men in heroic poses clutching rifles adorn the stone walls.
People are living in strange little apartments, underneath other buildings that were built 200 years ago. The roots of this go back through the Turkish period to the Ayyubids and right the way to the Romans.
As a reporter, Reese covered political rallies, shootings, and all sorts of events in Nablus. In the daily news narrative, this city is known for lawlessness, massed militants, and Israeli military raids. But as a novelist, Reese says, he's trying to get at something he wasn't able to do much as a reporter, explore how ordinary people live. To do that, he says, he's had to see the city in a whole new way.
Because as a journalist, you're really only looking to assess what's happening right now, why it's happening, and maybe what it's going to mean in the next couple of weeks. But as a writer of fiction, I want to know, maybe it's that music that keeps people going. You know, so what is that music? And it's in these places that I feel you find the most emotionally real elements of a town.
Deeper into Nablus's old city, tucked away from the bustle, up a steep staircase, we enter the courtyard of a collapsing palace. It was once a grand Nablus mansion of the Tukans, a wealthy family of traders.
And now we'll find many poor families living in what used to be the home of one rich family.
The roof is long gone. Weeds are growing almost ornately out of cracks in the high stone walls. The fountain of the once regal courtyard is choked with garbage. In Reese's novel, this broke-down palace, home to squatters and militants on the run, is a key setting for the book's action.
They live in the palace, but the palace becomes a slum. So everything is turned around from what you would expect. And that's what I'm trying to show about Palestine. It's never what you would expect.
Through a side door, you enter an overgrown orchard and garden in the heart of urban Nablus. The sun is beating down on long-neglected olive, pomegranate, and lemon trees in this hidden, decaying garden.
Assalamu alaikum. Alaafi, shabab.
A few squatters are eating lunch. A teenager nearby is feeding a mangy horse as the midday call to prayer begins.
And to stand in a place like this and look at the enormous hills right around the town, because it's in this deep valley, and to feel this heat, it's so intense. You just sweat standing here. It's wonderful. I've always loved it, and I've always tried to capture that, you know, on every page. It's incredible to see it.
In his first two books in the series, Rees exposed his readers to other, less well-known facets of Palestinian society. His detective, Omar Youssef, tangled with militants targeting the Arab Christian minority in the Collaborator of Bethlehem and waded into a web of clan and factional intrigues in A Grave in Gaza. Now, The Samaritan Secret centers on Nablus and the tiny ancient religious sect whose some 700 members still live on the outskirts of the city. In the novel, Omar Youssef races against time and the bad guys to solve a slew of mysteries. Murdered Samaritans, missing scrolls, and millions of dollars stolen, perhaps by a corrupt Palestinian leader. To solve the murders and avert further disaster in Nablus, Omar Youssef must explore the religious sect and its holy sites, including Mount Gerizim, which overlooks Nablus.
They believe that they had an ancient temple here where that sloping stone is that's been destroyed.
Samaritans believe it was here, on Mount Gerizim, not Jerusalem, where Abraham offered to sacrifice Isaac. Samaritans claim they're descendants of ancient Israelites who survived the Assyrian conquest of the Holy Land and remained here during the Babylonian exile and preserved what they see as the true religion of the Israelites. In The Samaritan's Secret, Mount Gerizim is the site of the novel's first murder. The detective comes to see the Samaritan's ancient Torah scroll right before the Samaritan's big feast of the sacrifice. But while there, the priest he's visiting hears that a Samaritan man has been beaten to death and thrown off the hill.
Jibril ben Tabia cradled the tarnished silver case of the Abisha scroll like a sooty newborn, rocking on his heels as if to lull it to sleep. The old priest wore a thin smock tight around his bony waist, and a cloth embroidered with a gold floral design twisted around his red fez. He gazed over a crowd of strangers who had come to the summit of Mount Gerizim to observe his people's Passover celebration. Where was the body? Khamis Zidane asked Omar Youssef.
Rees knows most of his readers will probably never visit the settings for his mysteries, but his series continues to take readers to places unexplored in the mystery genre and illustrate parts of Palestinian society mystery fans might not read about anywhere else. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, with author Matt Rees in Nablus.
And you can hear Matt Bynum and Rees read from The Samaritan Secret and find archives of our entire Crime in the City series at NPR.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
The economic news of late has been full of stories about big bailouts of big institutions. Now a story about a much smaller enterprise turning to the public for help. The owner of Wordsmiths, a well-known independent bookstore in Decatur, Georgia, is asking for donations to help pay off his debt and stay in business. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
Even before the current economic downturn, a lot of independent bookstores have been struggling to stay afloat. Faced with competition from chains and big box stores, independents try to create a sense of community with their customers, a community bound by a love of books. So when Zachary Steele, the owner of Wordsmiths, found himself facing a mountain of debt, he went online to ask his loyal customers to contribute money to what he considers a worthy cause, keeping his store open.
Honestly, the only thing that made me think that I could do it was that if I opened my mouth, maybe it would work.
In his message, Steele was honest about his plight. We're not fighting declining sales, customer apathy, or even a lagging book market, he wrote. Instead, he explained, the store had originally opened in a bad location. Now in a better space, it had a second chance to succeed, if Steele could pay off his debt. In other words, Steele faces the kind of problem that many small businesses face. But bookstores, Steele says, are different. They play a special role in people's lives.
I like to think of my business as a little bit more than just a retail operation, since we work so closely with so many literary causes here in the area, and I'd love to be able to keep doing that.
Among those who agree with Steele is Mark Sarvis, who wrote about Wordsmith's troubles on his literary blog, The Elegant Variation. Sarvis says he couldn't bear to see another independent bookstore going out of business. He says this isn't the first time an independent bookseller has turned to the book reading community for help, though he acknowledges it is unusual to ask people to donate money to a for-profit business.
It can be read either as a sign of how desperate the times are for booksellers, or also could be read as a sign of the creativity and the original lengths to which, you know, booksellers are willing to try to go to keep serving their communities. And obviously, if they are successful, in reverse, it's a measure of how much communities want to keep their bookstores, that they'll step up and they'll help them out.
If they really want to help out the needy, why would he be your first choice? Maybe the community's better off with a guy who can make the bookstore turn a profit.
Tyler Cowan teaches economics at George Mason University in Virginia. He's not convinced that bookstores should be exempt from the vagaries of a market-driven economy.
I think we all like to have this notion that an independent bookstore is owned and run by someone who loves books and just doesn't care about money as the only thing in life. And that's great, but still the store has to at least break even. And if this guy can't do that, there's just no way he'll stay in business with or without charity.
Zachary Steele says he's not asking for charity. He plans to give something back to those who donate, special discounts or store credit, for example.
I'm not asking for a handout. I'm asking for help, just to get over the hump. And then I intend on making it up to everybody. And my desire would be, to go above and beyond that afterward.
Givebacks or not, Mark Sarvis says, maybe the rules should be relaxed for bookstores.
Perhaps there's something not entirely rational about the love of books. It is a labor of love. People write books out of labors of love. They read them. It's a labor of love. And they certainly devote what is a spectacularly unremunerative way of life to selling them as a labor of love.
Apparently, there are a fair number of people who agree. Wordsmiths is already getting promises of donations from people in the community as well as around the country. And plans for events to benefit the bookstore are underway. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Back now with Day to Day. Standard advice for aspiring authors. Write what you know and where you know. California. The drama of the Pacific to the west and the Sierra Mountains inland. This is an especially luring literary landscape. From member station KUSP Santa Cruz, Rick Kleffel asks a number of writers about using where they live as a setting for their work.
James Houston lives in Santa Cruz, a small town on California's coast just south of San Francisco. His new collection of essays, Where Light Takes Its Color from the Sea, chronicles the strong relationship between his writing and the place he lives.
Well, I came to Santa Cruz in 1962. I was trying to get started as a writer, and I had an idea for a novel. I had a draft of a novel that had a lot to do with the Pacific Ocean, and I wanted to be near the ocean.
Houston and his wife bought an old Victorian house just a few steps from the Pacific Ocean. They later learned that it has a historical connection to the mountains of the Sierra Nevada, on the eastern edge of California.
One of the younger survivors of the Donner Party lived in his house at the end of her life. I wrote about that in my novel, Snow Mountain Passage. The Sierras play a big role in that novel. That's where the Donner Party got stuck.
The Donner Party spent the winter of 1846 trapped in the Sierras, fighting hunger and freezing weather. It was the Donner connection that made author Karen Joy Fowler decide to set her new novel, Wit's End, in a house inspired by James Houston's home.
The main thing I wanted from the Houston House is the fact that it was built by a survivor of the Donner Party, and I wanted a book that was about survivors.
In Wit's End, a ghostly survivor of the Donner Party haunts Rima Lanisel when she comes to stay in her godmother's seaside mansion in Santa Cruz. In this reading from Wit's End, Fowler describes a breathtaking interplay of light, air, and ocean as seen from the beach near Houston's home, the fictional house of her novel.
The sea was an indigo blue. Rima was becoming a connoisseur of Pacific colors, a pale translucent blue near the shore at dawn, but a silvered blue farther out, and the color of sunrise reflected on the sheen of the sand. Green waves on a sunny afternoon, though purple in the shade of the dredge, throwing white water into the air. Indigo after the sunset, and then black, but with lights playing over the surf in small, unexpected reds, greens, and yellows.
It's always been the light of Santa Cruz. It faces south.
Tom Killian is a writer and illustrator and a former student of Houston's. He provided a woodcut illustration for the cover of Houston's book, Where Light Takes Its Color from the Sea.
Not many places in Northern California face south and have water in front of them, and none of them on the scale that Monterey Bay has. So Santa Cruz really has extraordinary light. And when Jim had that title for that book, I said, oh, that title is perfect. I have the perfect print for you.
In the book, Houston combines nonfiction and fiction to describe where he lives and works.
A large part of what's going on in this collection is trying to clarify my own sense of place. So it's a very personal kind of pilgrimage in words to get myself located.
Karen Joy Fowler set her last novel, The Jane Austen Book Club, in Davis, California, where she was living at the time, and she began writing Wit's End there.
because we were planning on moving to Santa Cruz, used the excuse of the book as a way to get to know the place and came over a lot with research on my mind.
Fowler hadn't been in Houston's house before she started to write Wit's End, but while in college, cover artist Tom Killian had.
He would invite us over to his house here, this great house, this amazing big old house overlooking the ocean.
But for Houston, deciding to write about Santa Cruz wasn't easy.
Something came clear to me this one particular day in 1964. I wrote the essay that now opens the collection, The View from Santa Cruz. Up until then, I thought serious fiction and serious writing was about other places. And looking back, it's the first piece that I wrote where I sort of gave my permission to write as a person from California about being from this part of the world.
For Houston, Karen Joy Fowler, and Tom Killian, a single, possibly haunted house is the place that connects their daily, local lives to a larger literary world. For NPR News, I'm Rick Kleffel.
I am Netta Ulaby. This week on NPR's podcast, Book Tour, we'll hear bestselling author Anne Patchett read from her latest novel, Run.
Father Sullivan had lost his talent for sleeping. He still fell asleep. He fell asleep constantly. But sleep was like a bean he managed to balance for a moment on his nose. He had no ability to hold it.
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please go to npr.org/booktour.
Writer Doris Lessing is in her late 80s and still hard at work. Lessing won a Nobel Prize last year, and now she has published her first post-Nobel novel. It's called Alfred and Emily. Here's our reviewer, Alan Chews.
Alfred and Emily, published on the verge of Doris Lessing's 89th birthday, combines in an idiosyncratic fashion personal history, public history, and fiction, all about her father and mother. When writing about parents, Lessing says, even alert offspring or children may miss gold. She hasn't missed the gold in her past. In the first half, Lessing delivers a long and lively novella about her parents' lives in an imaginary England in which the First World War does not take place. This is a silly, petty, pettifogging little country, Alfred Taylor, her father says, in this variation on his actual history. And we're pleased with ourselves because we've kept out of a war. But if you ask me, I think a war would do us all the good in the world. The actual war did not, as it happens, turn out to do him all the good in the world. He lost a leg in battle. But after meeting Emily in a hospital where she worked as a nurse attending wounded British soldiers, Alfred married her. The couple emigrated with great hopes for their future, first to Persia, where Taylor worked in a bank, and then to Rhodesia, where they bought a farm. In the second half of this book, Lessing reconstructs her childhood on that farm in Africa, giving us, as trusted novelists will, the gestures and mores of that particular time in her life and of the period. She shows us the land around the farm, which was, as she says, marked by an old mawonga tree, always full of birds. We'll never get off the farm, her mother says, and they'll bury us under the mawonga tree. When Lessing returned to the old African home ground in the early 1980s, she tells us, the tree was gone. Will this odd and powerful excursion into lost time last, or will it go the way of that mawonga tree? For now, it serves as a marker of an older day and a powerful reminder, not only about Doris Lessing's past, but how each of us can return to our own family histories and, if we pay close attention, come back with something gold.
The new novel by Doris Lessing is called Alfred and Emily. Our reviewer is Alan Chews. He teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
And now the intersection of faith and fiction on the Talk of the Nation opinion page. Tomorrow, August 12th, was supposed to be the publication date of a new historical novel about Aisha, the youngest wife of the Prophet Muhammad, called Jewel of Medina. But the Ballantine Division at Random House postponed publication this past May due to fears that the book would offend some Muslims and might incite a few to violence. Asra Nomani wrote about the story in the Wall Street Journal. Her op-ed is called You Still Can't Write About Muhammad. She's a journalist and a regular contributor to NPR's Tell Me More and joins us here in Studio 3A. And it's nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks.
And we also want to hear from listeners. Should Random House have published the book? What's the line between censorship and taste when it comes to fiction about religious figures? Our phone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog, where you'll find a statement from Random House and from Sherry Jones, the author of The Jewel of Medina, as well as excerpts from the book. And since the book has not been published, this is one of the few chances to see her writing firsthand. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And let me ask you, Asra Nomani, tell us about the book.
Well, I've got it here. I got my galley earlier this summer, and it was my summer reading. It took me all of this last few months to basically absorb this book and whether it deserved to see the light of day. You know, I grew up on reading The Red Tent, read The Da Vinci Code, and I've increasingly believed that historical fiction is critical for understanding Islamic history. The book basically takes you into the life of Aisha, the youngest wife of the Prophet Muhammad, who was one of a harem full of wives. And it takes you, like any novel, through her struggles and tribulations from girlhood to womanhood. It takes you into issues of lust, love, jealousy, intrigue, battles, politics, all of the stuff that was the story of the birth of Islam.
Could be pretty sensitive stuff for some people.
It could be. And also it's, you know, the kind of stuff that I don't think most people know about. You know, in this book, you are basically going into the trenches in the way novels take you, into stories about the battles and about the wives and the alliances and the companions who were all elbowing for power. And so in that way, you know, you actually have the sort of life breathed into the life of into the pages of Islamic history.
So the same way that we might learn about the history of the Tudor kings through that the other Boleyn girl,
right.
This might let some people who wouldn't ordinarily learn much about Islam in the early period learn about Aisha.
Yeah, and there's going to be moments, and there are moments of that are going to be seriously offensive to Muslims who revere Aisha and Muhammad and Ali and Umar and Abu Bakr and all of the people of the birth of Islam in a way that, you know, doesn't allow us to see their humanity oftentimes. But like any good novel, it's a tale of redemption and reconciliation. And so, you know, you have to sort of play it out.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us about the story behind the story and why that novel is not going to be on bookshelves tomorrow.
Well, I got the book in the beginning of the summer, like I mentioned, because Sherry Jones had read some of my work and she was trying to rally support for against this decision by Random House.
Well, how did the decision come about? Yeah.
Well, what happened is that Random House sent the galleys to professors and academics, and a professor in the University of Texas at Austin, Denise Spellberg, got a copy of the book, and she had written her own academic book about Aisha. She was seriously offended by the book. She is on contract with another imprint at Random House, contacted her editor on April 30th. The editor spoke to her and in an email to Random House executives told the other parts of the publishing house that this professor thought that the book would be a national security threat, that it was virtually a declaration of war with the Muslim world, and that Random House would face serious backlash, security and safety-wise.
Well, she wasn't the only one who felt that way.
Well, apparently then what happened is within a day, Random House decided that they would possibly postpone the publication. But then they shipped the book off to, I've been told, three other experts and were given warnings that, in fact, there might be security risks. They checked with their security officials and decided that they didn't want to take the risk. And so by late June, a termination agreement had been signed.
Well, let me just read a little bit of what Random House had to say. They sent us a statement, I think the same statement they sent to everybody. After sending out advance editions of the novel Jewel of Medina, we received in response from credible and unrelated sources unsolicited cautionary advice not only that the publication of this book might be offensive to some in the Muslim community, but also that it could incite acts of violence by a small radical segment. We stand firmly by our responsibility to support our authors and the free discussion of ideas, even those that may be construed as offensive offensive by some. However, a publisher must weigh that responsibility against others that it also bears, and in this instance we decided, after much deliberation, to postpone publication for the safety of the author, employees of Random House Incorporated, booksellers, and anyone else who would be involved in distribution and sale of the book. So they do have such a responsibility.
Right, and so they came out on the side of caution. And what's been really fun this last week is that the blogs and the internet are the only things ablaze with comments and debate and back and forth about whether or not this book should be published. Muslims are weighing in on literary websites, and I think just what I'd hope would happen is happening. Sure, we might end up with a scenario that has played out in other situations like the cartoon controversy, but I believe
the Danish cartoons with caricatures of Muhammad.
But what I argue in my piece and what I believe firmly as a Muslim and as a writer is that we can't allow the lowest common denominator in society to define our conversations as civilizations. And literature is a critical element in moving civilizations forward. We've got to accept that. And we also need to allow for the kind of conversations that would actually move the Muslim world and the West together forward.
Yet you say that might happen. Hundreds of people were killed in rioting over those Danish cartoons.
I know, and I'm not naive about any of the risks that are playing out because of ideologies out there that support violence. But at the same time, I know that we can be pretty smart, and we can try to figure out how to take on challenges like that.
Let's see if we get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And we'll begin with Abu. And Abu's with us from Charlottesville in Virginia.
Hello. How are you doing, sir?
Very well, thanks.
Thank you for receiving my call. I agree with your guest completely. You see, I'm a Muslim. I mean, some of the things that are going on is actually, to me, as far as I'm concerned, it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, I mean, there should be a religious freedom. I mean, we're all free to say what we want to say. And I feel like Random House should have the opportunity to actually publish a book, regardless of what the situation would be. I mean, all said and done, is at the same time, I strongly disagree with the Danish cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad. I mean, that is way to the extreme. But, I mean, talking about Prophet Muhammad's wife, these are the things that happen in daily life. I mean, it's about politics. It's about how human beings would behave in terms of jealousy and everything else. So I see no reason why that book should not be published. Because as a Muslim, I do believe that until we are able to debate certain points or certain opportunities, I don't think the problem will ever solve. We as Muslims should be able to sit down, even though we disagree, we should be able to sit down and debate certain issues and say, look, you are wrong. This is how we say it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the first principles we're ever taught as children of Muslim families is this concept of adab. It's etiquette, and it's about our decorum as Muslims in society. And sadly, I feel like in the politics of the day, that's been one of the first things to go, and that's what I wish we could invoke again as a guiding principle when we deal with controversial issues.
Right, right.
Okay, Abu, thanks very much for the call.
Certainly.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go next to, this will be Ahmed. Ahmed is with us from Minneapolis.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I actually wanted to comment that and the publishing house, the publishing company, made the right decision not to publish that because, first of all, this novel would have been as offensive to the Muslims as a novel which would depict Mary as an adulterous woman, which will still be offensive to Muslims and Christians. So this would be very offensive to Muslims worldwide in a time that there's a lot of tension between the Muslim majority parts of the world and the West. I don't think we need any more tension like this going around in different very critical areas of the world that actually would put the life of the troops in danger, as well as the Christians and the people, Westerners, who are actually working in Muslim-majority countries with the people who are not understanding the proper way to deal with this. Because if you were to look at the life of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, himself, there were many times that he was insulted. People did all sorts of things to him. They yelled at him. They screamed at them. They insulted him. And he dealt with it in a very proper way. But many Muslims, I'm afraid, around the world would not follow his ways, ironically, and they would resort to violence. So I really think the publishing company made the right decision not to publish a novel like this.
But don't you feel sad that as a community that we are defined by that lowest common denominator, and that when we talk about Muslims and them responding with violence, that then includes you and me?
Ahmed? He may have left
Ahmed,
us.
Yeah, and that is ultimately like my sadness about this, because, you know, as soon as you start dealing with any community in monolithic terms, you are not having a very sophisticated conversation. And that's exactly what's been that's happened here. And, you know, ultimately, I don't want the extremist, violent element of any society to define all of any community.
We're talking with Asra Nomani on the opinion page, her op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, "You Still Can't Write About Mohammed." You can find a link to it on our website at npr.org/blog of the nation. And this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And you mentioned earlier the scholar Denise Spellberg, who was involved in this controversy. She also wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal saying she did not kill the Jewel of Medina, that she was one of many people consulted, and she doesn't have the power to spike a novel. But she also said that the book is poorly researched and presents a fallacious picture of a very real person's life, that she would have been fine with it if it had been accurate.
Right. I think a clear issue with that kind of criticism is, you know, we could all get in line on books that we don't think pass muster. And, you know, I think that there's a novel offers us a real insight and window into issues about women. It brings to life names like Khadija and Salama and Aisha and Fatima, who are otherwise not commonly known outside the Muslim world. But I'm not a literary critic. And I think that if we get into the business of, you know, raising red flags because a book just isn't good, then we've got problems.
It was going to be published, we should point out, by Ballantine Books, Random House. Apparently they thought its literary merits at least qualified rated publication.
Right. The you know, letter from the editor said that she was up all night, you know, reading the book and couldn't put it down.
There was an agreement that she could also market it now to other publishers. Right. They've withdrawn from the deal. So,
and as I understand it, the book will be published. The publishers are lining up to put it out there. And I really do believe that the Muslim world can absorb this book just as the Christian world absorbed the Da Vinci Code, Last Temptation of Christ, and all of the other, you know, creative expressions that people thought took too much license with history.
Let's talk with Mabel. Mabel with us from Greenwood Springs in Colorado.
Hi.
Hi. Excuse me, Glenwood Springs.
Glenwood Springs. We're criticizing a book that we haven't even read. But with the word, the use of the word harem or harim for the prophet's wives, that's very inaccurate to begin with. He married for political alliance and to protect widows whose husbands had been killed in battle. And if the book is going to be that inaccurate, I don't say not publish it, but I don't know what to do about not publishing or publishing. That's another issue. I'm just worried about that kind of inaccuracy.
I think that that's just the kind of conversation books elicit. You know, that's why there are book clubs, and that's why authors go on lecture circuits, because we're meant as writers to stimulate conversation. We can't settle debates, I don't think, many times. But writers have, you know, annoyed and irked great powers and conventional wisdom since the beginning of time. And no author, I think, can ever claim to get it all right. But what we can try to do is start conversations.
Yes. And all in all, I'm fascinated by Aisha and the other wives. They were great women.
Yeah, and I think what the, you know, ultimately this book landed on my lap because I firmly believe, just like women in Christian and Jewish histories have had to do, we have to reclaim the stories of women in Islamic history because they've been forgotten. And while they may be revered, we hardly know the, you know, tales of Hajar when she was standing in Mecca with her baby Ishmael, and yet we walk in her footsteps every time we do the pilgrimage to Mecca. And so this is my own dream as a Muslim woman in the 21st century, that we actually take back their stories and start debates on in the modern day.
Thank you, Mabel.
Thank you.
Here's an email from Ross in Brooklyn, New York. Random House is a publisher and a business. This is not censorship. Nobody's stopping Random House from publishing the book but themselves because they think that's what's best for their business. It's only censorship if somebody stopped Random House from publishing the book, not if they decide to do it themselves.
Well, you know, of course, Random House is a corporation, and so they decided at one point that this was a good money-making venture, and then they decided, wait a second, no, it isn't. Other publishing houses, like I mentioned, are going to make that same equation. I wouldn't doubt it if we end up with a movie out of this novel, because ultimately imaginations of people have been captured, and that's what writers try to do.
And then we get into the fight over images of Muhammad, which is a whole other thing.
Right, and that's one we need to take on too.
Asra Nomani, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Asra Nomani is a journalist and a regular contributor to NPR's Tell Me More. You can find a link to her Wall Street Journal op-ed on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. You can also find there the statement from Random House and from Sherry Jones, the author, along with excerpts from The Jewel of Medina at our blog as well, npr.org/blogofthenation. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.